its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Later on this hour, we will update the story involving the Enbridge oil pipeline, which runs through, or underneath, I should say, the Straits of Mackinac. There's been a news, we had planned a segment on this story all along, but there's been a news update on this particular story just in the past few hours, so we will update that with the Associated Press's John Flesher coming up later this hour. Also, one of the real people of the hour here, Sandy Zirkle, is the chair of the Lansing Board of Water and Light. There was an extended session, an extended meeting of the Board of Water and Light last night, at which an awful lot, a great many opinions regarding the utility's response to the ice storm were aired last night. A good deal of support and criticism of General Manager Peter Lark was aired last night. We will talk with Sandy Zirkle, who's the chair of the LBWL board, about everything that went down at the meeting last night. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along here today for Current State. It's Wednesday, which means it's Neighbors in Action Day here on Current State, when we visit with area residents doing their part to make life better here in the Lansing, East Lansing, Mid-Michigan area. We have, of course, weathered two major winter storms here in the past 3 weeks. It's been widely reported that thousands of people who lost power following the December 21st ice storm found themselves with little or no reliable information about when or if their electricity would be restored. That prompted a number of citizens in the community to take it upon themselves to go looking for answers and to share what they found online. In today's Neighbors in Action segment, we're talking with two of those people. Dan Ryan lives in Lansing. Alice Drager is an East Lansing resident, and both spent a great deal of time on social media relaying critical information about the outage. Dan and Alice, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan, what was your experience with the storm exactly? How were you impacted by it?
I was without power for 11 days. I was one of the last 500 people to get power, I believe. There was also
11 days.
11 days.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I got on the leaderboards on that one.
Okay. And at what point did you begin looking for answers about the outage from the BWL?
Well, looking for answers was probably day one. Looking for any sort of information about timelines or estimates or even really trying to... If anything, really, I was just hoping to get the phone call through, like being able to actually have someone at the BWL answer their phone.
And so ultimately, you took it upon yourself to do what?
Well, I started Christmas Day. We were staying at my brother's house in Bath, and I was driving back twice a day to check on the house to make sure the pipes didn't freeze, things like that. And as I was driving back and forth, especially at night, I realized just how dark everything was.
Mm-hmm.
Entire streets, entire neighborhoods, just completely pitch black. And trying to find answers for that, I realized that I wasn't the only person. I mean, obviously, there were a lot of people affected as well, but it wasn't until I started driving back and forth that I realized just the sheer magnitude mm-hmm. of the problem.
And you had to end up acting as something of a field reporter here. How did you get started with that? Who did you talk to?
Well, it started on the Facebook posts on the Board of Water and Light's own Facebook page. They would provide updates every hour, every 8 hours or so, with the exception of the weekend, where it went up to 18 hours without an update from the BWL. There were people asking for information, anything, has anyone even seen a truck mm-hmm. in the area or in any areas? And since I was driving back and forth, I actually stumbled across a couple of them. And so I relayed that information, and then people started asking me for more information. And so I kept driving.
Okay. Alice Drager, tell us how you responded to this. How were you impacted, first of all, by the storm, and how did you respond?
We live right about a quarter mile away from City Hall, a quarter mile away from Michigan State, all of which never lost power. Our neighborhood in Oakwood lost power for 9 days. And what I did was try, as other people did, to get power restored. And I decided that once we did get power restored, I would follow the lead of Dan and try to help other people get restored. You know, the important thing to understand, you mentioned that Dan was doing social media, and that's true, he was, but he was doing something much more important. He was actually going out and checking for real to see what was really on and what was really off. What Jeff Pratt in East Lansing and Dan Ryan in Lansing and I discovered was that you couldn't trust the Board of Water and Light system to know who was on and who was off. Mm-hmm. In fact, what happened was the Board of Water and Light system kept erasing people's outage reports. It was doing that in part because of the way the line reporting system happens. The line report would report that, for example, a block was back on, but what it wouldn't know was that individual houses had lines down, so they weren't connected to that line.
Okay.
But their outage report would be wiped out of the system, and these families wouldn't know that they had been wiped out of the system, and they would sit in the dark waiting, hoping. Some of them would keep calling, but over and over again, BWL's outage system would wipe them out of the system. So what we were doing was driving around and actually finding out for real who had power, who didn't have power. If they said somebody was reconnected, we contacted the homeowner to see if it was true, and a lot of times it wasn't true, and we agitated for them again and again and again to get them reconnected. There was one family I had to ask 5 times because BWL or the police kept saying they were reconnected. They weren't reconnected. I've never met these people. I just worked with them on the phone. So that was the kind of stuff that we were doing. We were trying to find electricians for people. We were trying to find generators. I tried to organize firewood for my neighborhood, which the city clerk of East Lansing personally provided. I asked the city for hot showers for people so they could get their core body temperatures back up. Basically, what we were doing were needs assessments and on-the-ground reporting as to what people needed. And this wasn't being done adequately by the cities, and it certainly wasn't being done adequately by BWL.
And you camped out at the Hanna Center in East Lansing, where you gathered an awful lot of information, correct?
I did. I sat there for many hours with the folks from BWL. I ended up making friends with people from BWL. And what was clear to me was they were struggling against a system that was broken. So we were trying to help fill in the gaps of the system that was broken. Those people were working really hard. The BWL reps at those centers were working really hard. The line crews were working really hard. They did not have a system that supported the level of work they were having to put in.
Dan, tell us more about how this unfolded throughout the course of your activity here. Then, did you focus primarily on Facebook then, or what?
I focused both on Facebook and on Twitter. I created a Twitter account called BWL Outage, and any new information that I found, if I came across an area that was supposedly being worked on and didn't have any crew activity, or as Alice mentioned, if there were homes that were confirmed green by the board but were still dark, I would post both on Twitter, on the Twitter account, as well as Facebook as well.
What has the Board of Water and Light Administration had to say about your activities? Anything?
I think they basically don't want to hear from us, from what I can tell. I think they want to tell a story that's a happy story, that everybody worked hard and everybody did a great job. Everybody did work really hard, but the system was broken in which they were working, and there hasn't yet been an honest assessment of the ways in which that system was broken. The number one issue was there weren't enough crews on the ground. As Dan mentioned, we would drive around trying to find a single crew, and it was really hard to find crews. And when you found crews, they were tired, they were working 16-hour days, they were working nonstop, 7 days a week. It was clear to us, doing the simple math, it was going to take forever to get reconnected unless they got more crews. And it took until we organized a protest and people went down to the press conference and turned that into a protest before BWL finally hired crews. Once they hired crews, everything started to change. So my neighborhood, for example, was out 9 days, 34 houses on a single line. And we told them that. It's one line that's down, 34 houses. It took, when the crew showed up, 45 minutes to fix it. A couple of guys, a wire and a fuse, 45 minutes, and we were finally out of the dark. Now, why did it take that long? It took that long because we didn't have enough crews. And that crew didn't find us because BWL sent them, because BWL kept losing everybody in the outage system. What happened was a neighbor of ours, a few blocks north, had power back and noticed a crew working on a couple of houses. He went over to them and he said to them, "Listen, there's a whole neighborhood just a few blocks out that's completely in the dark. Would you please go over there next?" And they did. They came over to us not because BWL sent them. They came over because a neighbor begged them to come help us. And they came over. 45 minutes later, we're back up. 9 days later.
We're talking with Dan Ryan of Lansing and Alice Drager of East Lansing, who both took it upon themselves to share important information online and social media here rather spontaneously after the recent ice storm here in mid-Michigan. Dan, could you tell you were connecting with an awful lot of people after you were at this for a while?
Yeah, actually, at first it was just me doing some scouting around the areas and trying to find things. But after a while, really after maybe the first night, other people started posting to Facebook that they too were driving around in their own neighborhoods, looking for crews, finding activity, posting information back to the Facebook page. I was also getting a lot of people on Twitter as well, sending me details about status updates and crews also.
Do you two have jobs? I mean,
are
you now unemployed as a result of all of this activity?
Thankfully, yeah. No, but...
No, seriously.
No,
I mean,
we do have jobs. I do purposely work part-time so I can do advocacy work, but my normal advocacy work is for medical issues, for medical ethics issues. I don't normally do this kind of advocacy work. But I dropped everything and did advocacy work for this, and I think Dan had extraordinary skills, and we were following his lead in many ways. You know, I have to tell you a story about Dan, and that is that 10 days in, I got a direct message from Jeff Pratt, our collaborator, and Jeff emailed me and said, I've got a special one for you. I really want you to work on this one. I said, sure, who is it? And he gives me the address, and he says, it's Dan Ryan. And I said, are you kidding me? Dan Ryan doesn't have power, and he's not even agitating for himself? And Jeff said, no. I said, man, I only took this up when I got power back. Dan has been working for the people for 10 days and not even really pushing for himself. So I called my buddies at BWL and was like, Dan Ryan doesn't have power. And they finally got on that one. But it was really, to me, extraordinary that he was working that hard for other people and while he was still with himself without power.
Do you think the board will be in? It sounds to me as if the Board of Water and Light will be incorporating some of the more sophisticated, up-to-date, 21st century social media tools that you two just took it upon yourself to launch into. Here, Alice, you were at the meeting last night. Is that your understanding?
They say they've hired a social media rep, and that's great. But you know, I'm not on Facebook. I just barely got on Twitter in the last few months. What I want to emphasize that a lot of what I did with the people I worked with in East Lansing, including Jeff, was knocking on doors. And this was fundamentally, to me, the problem of what happened, is people were relying on computers too much. They were assuming that the computers would tell them who was without power, who needed to still be put back on, how to do that. In fact, what I found again and again in East Lansing was the computers were wrong. And what I had to do was literally knock on a door. I knocked on so many strangers' doors. And you know what? Nobody ever begrudged me knocking on their door to ask them, do you have power? Everybody was happy to see you. Even if they had power, they said, yes, I have power.
So this was an emergency that required a more grassroots person-to-person, face-to-face approach.
Absolutely. And This is one of the things I asked of the police chief in East Lansing, and she took it upon herself to put together paper information. When on the ninth day or the eighth day that we were facing, I think it was December 29th, I was so cold and depressed, I decided to just do a needs assessment of my own neighborhood. So I walked around with pen and paper and knocked on the doors and asked people, are you still staying in the house? How many people are here? What fuel are you using? Do you have a carbon monoxide detector? And what do you need? And people told me what they needed, and I conveyed that need assessment to the police. My question is, why didn't the city sooner do that door-to-door needs assessment? Ask people simply, what do you need from us? And start getting them that. You know, people told me, I need a generator. People told me, I've got a generator. I need an electrician to hook it up. People told me, I just need more firewood. People told me, I need gas. These were basic needs that could have been met by the cities, but it's because people don't knock on doors. It's considered somehow impolite or inappropriate to go knock on a door and say, are you okay? Do you need anything? It's much more important in a situation like this, particularly because the most vulnerable are not on social media. Old people, people who are poor, they are not on social media. Those are the people who are the most vulnerable and need you to knock on the door.
Dan, do you agree? Tend to agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the reliance of the BWL to relay information solely on their Facebook page, I had to like their page and open up a lot of my own privacy controls just so that I could be able to communicate with people and with the BWL on Facebook. Luckily, I understand technology, so that's not a huge question to ask someone like me, but Alice is absolutely right. The elderly don't understand that. They mm-hmm. don't. They might not even have access to that. Mm-hmm. They may only have a radio.
But her larger point is that even if they did have access to it, this is the kind of emergency that required something different.
Yes.
Anyway, it really required an all of the above approach. Social media could very well have been a very constructive tool, but at the same time, it wasn't enough to get everybody through every challenge that they faced.
Absolutely,
you needed face to face conversations, and that's where you guys came through.
Yeah, this is definitely a situation where you had to try anything and everything, yeah, and all of it, so that everyone, as many people as possible, could hear that message.
Dan, have you been following the all of the controversy following the BWL after this?
Yes, I have.
Closely,
in fact, I was at the meeting last night.
You were there as
10:30.
Well. Oh, okay. How confident, given the fact that you were both at the meeting last night, how confident are you, Dan, that you can avoid going through this in the future? Are you prepared to be a citizen activist again here in the event of another severe ice storm?
I like to consider myself an optimist, but I'm going to keep that Twitter account open, and I'm going to continue keeping an eye on what the BWL is doing.
What's that handle again?
It is BWL Outage.
BWL Outage.
Yes,
okay.
That's the Twitter account, so at.
You were there last night as well, Alice. How confident are you that reforms, that what you did is going to be necessary on a grassroots level in the future?
I'm keeping my generator and keeping these contacts, too, because I'm not yet convinced that BWL is going to get it together in time for the next big problem. Lots of good people work there. There's no question lots of good people work there. But last night's meeting was, I have to say, shocking. What happened was, over and over again, BWL employees got up and praised Mr. Lark, the head of the company. In fact, they took up the time that was supposed to be dedicated to public citizens coming and reporting what they had done, what they had been through, what they thought would fix the problems. And instead of us really having the opportunity to do that, we were stuck sitting listening about how great a company it is. I don't doubt lots of good people work there. I want BWL to keep being my company. But that said, if that's what we're going to get is this kind of stonewalling, we're terrific, stop criticizing us, how dare you people criticize us, I have zero confidence that we're going to do a good, honest, in-depth analysis of what went wrong and fix it before it happens again. Last night's meeting left us, I think, more cynical, more bitter, more concerned. And that's terrible. At this point, really, BWL should be doing better. You know, they hired a PR company to try to help them. And the PR company last night on Twitter was distancing itself from BWL, saying, we weren't involved in the making of this meeting. We weren't involved in this. When your own PR company is doing damage control because it has a relationship with you, you have a problem.
We will learn more here in just a matter of minutes when Sandy Zirkle, the chairperson of the Lansing Board of Water and Light Board of Directors, joins us here. We will review other comments that were made throughout the course of last night's long meeting of the BWL. For now, we want to thank Dan Ryan of Lansing and Alice Drager of East Lansing. We appreciate you joining us here today for Neighbors in Action. Well
done. Thanks for having us.
We could always use more nominations, and we know that there are great people and organizations out there doing great work. We just don't know about them. So please help us out and send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org, put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Is there a video game culture in West Africa? With that question in mind, Detroit-based photographer Nick Hagen set out to see what he could find in Lagos, Nigeria. And Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Nick. Hi, Emmanuel. What did Nick find, anyway?
Well, what Nick discovered was a video game culture that's simultaneously familiar in some senses, but also really different, really unfamiliar. As you can imagine, access to game consoles and internet is limited in Lagos, Nigeria. So games are actually this really kind of communal activity where people are sharing resources to take part in it. Nick said Lagos is also just very different in general than the image that most people would have of Nigeria.
It's an ex-colony of England. So as a Westerner, when you've only experienced like Western media talking about Africa, you expect Africa to be like, I don't know, huts and people in like tribal garb. But it's this weird kind of like urbanized, little bit of Africa, primarily Western, people trying to talk Western, look Western, create buildings that are Western while retaining like a modicum of Africanness, basically, or Nigerianness, really. We should talk about like, yeah, we should know about Africa as a country, which is like a big lesson I learned there.
So you're on the other side of the world, and you decide that you want to take pictures of something I think many people think of as American, and that's video games. So why did you think it would be interesting to capture the video game culture over there?
Well, firstly, because I didn't know if it existed or not there. I really like video games, and it's always been an interest of mine, and it was just a tiny thought in my head before I left that, you know, I wonder if that's a thing that people do there. So I pursued it, tried to find it, and then I did, and it was a lot more interesting than I even thought it would be. I thought it was going to be really boring. Photo essay of just people standing there with controllers, but I ended up finding a lot more things. I mean, it's a whole cultural scene there, and it's a lot more sewn together and less separated than it is here.
How is it different than American video game culture?
Well, I think, you know, here in the West, people who want to play video games, they buy a console, they put it in their house, and they play it. And if they play cooperatively or interactively with other people, they do it over the internet. And there, that's not really the case because the internet infrastructure is so terrible. People just can't play online, and most people can't afford to have consoles of their own. So there are things called gaming centers that are set up where people, you know, start a business where they'll buy TVs, game consoles, charge a small fee, and people can come play together. So it's this more social, fun kind of communal environment, less than like, you know, the sad white guy in his house alone in his basement.
In the basement,
yeah, that we all know, playing RPGs by himself. So it's a cool, more like communal kind of thing over there.
So if I wanted to go play a game in Lagos, one of my favorite games is Soul Calibur, would I be able to find it? I mean, what's popular and what's available?
You probably could, because that's a fighting game. The one-on-one fighting games that are not from Nintendo are on there. I didn't see any Soul Calibur there, but I saw, what's this one? Oh, hold on. You know Naruto, right? It's this like anime. I never watched it, but it's like this kid in an orange jumpsuit. But there's this game called Ultimate Ninja Storm 3. It's this really intense like Japanese fighting game, and they were playing it like crazy when I was in a gaming center one day. So, you know, you can probably find anything. Just shooters, they really wouldn't do.
What other games were popular?
It was primarily football, so like soccer games, so FIFA, Pro Evolution Soccer, those, and then Street Fighter. So racing games like Burnout Paradise are also pretty popular, but it's primarily Street Fighter football games.
You said that this project was refreshing for you in a way because it's hard to photograph people in Lagos. Why is that?
People have a general fear, like the everyday person has a general fear of a white guy walking around with a big expensive looking camera. I got accused of all the time of, I would ask someone if I could take their picture, I would try to negotiate and they would just keep accusing me of like, I would take their picture, I would go back home, I would make $1 million off of it and they wouldn't see a penny of it, which really isn't the case. It's never gonna happen. But in their head, that's just how the culture is. There's like a bit of a mistrust going on with media now because, you know, the media doesn't paint Africa in a very good way for the most part. And I think everyday people have kind of picked up on that. So, you know, I'm used to being here or in Europe or like just going out in the street and just taking photos of things. And there I would just get hassled and questioned and get looks like no other. So to do this project where I could just walk into a space where people are playing games and they were like not caring at all about what I'm doing. It was nice. It was good.
Why do you think it was easier? I mean, just they were so absorbed or?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it's a less tense environment. They're all just playing games, you know, they're just hanging out. So maybe me being there was more validating than just being in like the street in some random place where I'm trying to take pictures of their daily life. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they were just absorbed in what they were doing and they didn't really care at all. I mean, I could get an inch from a guy's face and he would just still be staring at the TV screen and not even like notice me, which is really cool. I loved that.
What are some of your favorite images from the collection that you've taken?
I think the guy who's taking a phone call on his smartphone with his head tipped, balancing it on his head while still playing a game against his buddy is one of the better ones I got. I saw it happening. I'm like, that is just such a gift. Because it's funny because he's taking a phone call while playing a game. So clearly he's not like that absorbed in what he's doing. But it's also interesting because people wouldn't think that there are smartphones in Africa to begin with. It's just all this tech just being in that one photo in this continent that people think is shrub. It's just kind of awesome, I think. Another one I thought was hysterical was this guy, Shay, who runs a gaming center that I spent a lot of time in, playing a racing game with his buddy with a steering wheel and pedals while wearing 3D glasses in this kind of like shoddy wood environment. And it, again, it's this clashing of developing world and first world stuff coming together.
Talk a little about the physical space of the gaming centers. So everyone comes to these, there's TVs, PlayStations, but like, what are they actually in?
The few that I saw were very small rooms, just built of cheap wood, basically, on shoddy benches with shoddy tables with TVs crammed on there. Very cramped, loud, really hot. They had fans in there blowing, but it really didn't help. And it's just kids and men just together playing games and like yelling and having a fantastic time.
You also captured kind of the programming and development side. What's that atmosphere like? What is programming and development like in Nigeria?
Passionate, really. I mean, when I went to go visit Sportus, the company that I photographed, I expected it to be maybe five guys who were just in a, you know, someone's apartment. But I came into this rented space that was two floors that had like 40 guys hanging out in it, all on computers, hanging out, talking about games. There's some photos in there where they were just watching trailers and having the best time doing it. Like, a dragon showed up in one and they all just started yelling, like just loving it. So overall, I'd say they just love it. They love doing it. It's this niche thing that's just not, you have to kind of like dig for it. In Nigeria. So I think that makes them all the more passionate because they really have to like get into it.
What types of games are they producing? Or I guess how are these games different than what we're used to in America?
Well, those guys are kind of doing, they're kind of off on their own, but they're doing one that's I believe it's a sci-fi RPG starring them. Like all their friends are kind of characters in it. So it's like, it's this dark-skinned astronaut guy floating around his spaceship fighting aliens, which is fantastic, I think.
That's great to me.
Right? Yeah. Because, like, sci-fi out of Africa, you don't usually see, and I think that's, like, a totally untapped thing. But there are other companies like Malio Games who, they make very Africa, Nigerian-specific content. Like, there's one called Mosquito Smasher, where the whole point is, you know, let's not get malaria and kill the mosquitoes before they get you. So you just control this thumb that just stomps on mosquitoes. Or one called Okada Driver, where it's a racing game. But, you know, most racing games made in the West, you don't have to worry about potholes. But in this game, this will, like, wreck your bike if you hit a pothole because they're everywhere in LEGO. So, I don't know. It's very interesting to see, like, very specific African content coming out of that country because it's never going to happen anywhere else.
This project really kind of, the coolest thing about it is that you would never think video games in Africa. I mean, is that what you're hoping people take away from it?
Yeah, definitely. There's video games in Africa, there's video games everywhere, but particularly I wanted to show another side of Africa beyond just the typical media, babies with flies in their eyes, vultures kind of thing. It's important to show things like tech or people having fun or playing video games. Like, that story was just not going to get told, I don't think. So I think that's a really, really important aspect to the work, beyond just the fact that video games are fun.
Nick, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Nick Hagen is a Detroit-based photojournalist. He recently returned from a curatorial fellowship in Lagos, Nigeria. You can view his photos of Nigerian gamers at nickhaganphotography.com.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. About a month ago, U.S. Senators Carl Levin and Debbie Stabenow of Michigan sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Transportation asking about an Enbridge Company oil pipeline that runs through the Straits of Mackinac. They asked for information on safety tests done on the pipeline and for emergency response information from Enbridge. That information is not required to be made public, and that's been just one of the concerns of environmental groups over the past several years. Now, just today, the lawmakers heard back from the head of the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, and joining us now to talk about the evolution of this story is John Flesher. John's the Associated Press environmental correspondent based out of Traverse City. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Read your byline for years. It's a pleasure to finally talk to you. So in a letter here dated January 3rd and referred to in today's Detroit Free Press, the main pipeline person in the Obama administration has told Senator Stabenow that Enbridge has taken steps to improve pipeline safety in the region. But just looking at the story preliminarily here, it sounds like a redacted version of the emergency plan will need a FOIA request to read, although the Obama administration spokesperson says it will be available online in the near future on the Pipeline Administration website. That seems to be where we're at. What do you make of this?
Well, all along there have been limits on what the government would require the companies to put forth as far as some of these safety measures that they take and the results inspections that they do. The law just requires that certain things be put forth. And the company themselves, when they're asked about this, have replied that some of this information is proprietary and other information raises national security concerns, and so they're reluctant to make all of the details public.
Are you inclined to FOIA for this information?
Certainly. Certainly, if it can be obtained in that manner, it's the kind of thing that the public would no doubt have an interest in.
Do you intend to do that?
I do. I'm sure others in the news media will as well.
So to backtrack to the start of this story, because it does get complicated, it more or less began with the National Wildlife Federation's concern over this pipeline. The NWF began looking more closely at the Straits pipeline after the Enbridge spill in the Marshall area a few years ago, which folks will remember was about 800,000 gallons of oil. Now, one of the Wildlife Federation's biggest concerns is that they say Enbridge has never made public the reports that document the condition of the pipes. The feds don't require oil companies to release pipeline inspection reports. And the Obama administration spokeswoman did say that information about leak detection and integrity testing on the Straits pipeline is being compiled and will be sent soon. Could this indicate a change in policy, possibly forthcoming?
It could. Again, it boils down to what the law requires and what the government feels inclined to require the companies to put forward. I know that after the Enbridge spill, there was some legislation passed. Although according to what the PHMSA director provided to the senators, this apparently applies more to gas pipelines than to oil pipelines, and so it's still uncertain as to exactly what they will be required to provide.
And Enbridge is piping more oil through this line than in the past, correct? Can you give us a little history of that?
Well, yes, the line has been there for some 60 years now, and just within the past year, the Enbridge did increase the capacity by a couple of million gallons up to about 20.6 million capacity. It was 20.6, now it's up to about 22, so you're talking about roughly a 10% increase, and they say that the line is perfectly capable of handling that. The concern that the National Wildlife Federation and others have is where it goes down and breaks into two separate pipes and runs beneath the Straits of Mackinac for obvious reasons. If there were to be a spill in the Straits, it could be quite an environmental catastrophe.
Well, the National Wildlife Federation sent folks on a dive in July to check out the condition of the pipeline. They ended up posting a video of the pipeline while on the dive. They say it looks rickety in places. Enbridge says it's been tested thoroughly and is safe. How do you think this disagreement gets resolved?
Well, that's hard to say. I don't know that it will be resolved to the satisfaction of both parties. The NWF continues to have grave concerns about that. They are pushing for the release of any inspection data that company or PHMSA will provide. And if that information is provided, that may help to allay the concerns somewhat. But the NWF and other environmental groups believe that this pipeline should be replaced because it's been around for such a long time, and anything short of that may not be enough to allay all of the concerns.
What do you make of the fact? Are you under the impression that a lot of Michiganders are learning about this pipeline for the first time as a result of this story?
Probably so. It is not something that was really in the news or in the public conscience, I think, for much time prior to that. Of course, it hasn't been exactly kept secret. Anyone who wanted to do some research or look into it could easily find that the pipeline did exist. And there have been other points along that pipeline where there have been some occasional leaks, that type thing, that have been in the news. But the fact that the line ran under the Straits of Mackinac, my hunch is, did catch a lot of people by surprise.
All right. Well, we'll continue to keep an eye on this story. We want to thank John Flesher, Associated Press environmental correspondent based out of Traverse City. Thanks, John.
You're most welcome.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. You can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Follow us on Twitter at @KARCurrentState. Well, the citizen board that oversees the embattled Lansing Board of Water and Light convened last night. The body heard from both the public as well as BWL employees and leadership about the utility's response to last month's overwhelming ice storm that knocked out electric power to tens of thousands of people in the Lansing area. Hundreds of citizens are clamoring for an inquiry into the utility. Many have blasted the BWL for a communication breakdown with customers, some of whom waited up to 11 days for power to be restored. But praise for the BWL and its embattled general manager, Peter Lark, dominated last night's session. Lark announced a series of reforms, including a top-to-bottom review of the utility to address many of the complaints aired since the outage. And joining us to revisit last night's meeting is the chairman of the BWL board, Sandy Zirkel.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Before we get into the series of reforms announced last night, I'd like to ask you about the hours of public comment about the BWL's response and about all the speakers who voiced often passionate support for General Manager Peter Lark. What did you take away from those 3 hours of comments?
I probably was a little surprised at the beginning, but then when I talked to the our employees afterwards, and as you heard, several of them that were on the panel to give us instructions, they were waiting. They had been waiting to talk about that for some time. We try very hard. I kind of moved some of the customers up when we saw the list so that they could take precedence over some of the employees. And as you know, Mr. Lowney had indicated that if they wanted to wait until after to make their comments, they could. But all those employees stayed there. I want to make it very clear that I was in charge of the list, and there was not a single person that had signed up to make a public comment that did not get an opportunity to speak. So everyone got their 3 minutes, including all of our customers that had their concerns and their disgruntlements.
One critic still called last night's session a poorly managed PR stunt. Do you feel that all the support shown for General Manager Lark last night, do you feel that support is reflective of the larger community's attitudes?
Obviously, at this point, there's still, you had a couple of people on earlier, and there's obviously still some concern about how we handled it. So that's not a total reflection, but everyone on the board that sits as the commission felt very strongly that every employee that works at the Board of Water and Light did everything and anything they could to restore the power as quickly and safely as they possibly could, and there was no question about doing that. As you know, the line people were working 18 hours off for six. Actually, it was 16 hours off eight for probably 2 weeks. We brought in all the extra crews to do that, to assist with that. So I know that there is still the disgruntlement, but we are trying to do what we... The communications probably was the worst problem that we faced and the biggest complaint, not letting customers know where the problems were, how they were going to get fixed. The phone system had failed, so people couldn't get through. So that's, probably the biggest concern that the customers had, not the fact that we didn't care or weren't there when we should have been. It's just that we had complaints. People saw the trucks going through their neighborhood and didn't stop, or they stopped in front of their house and then left. And there's always reasons for that, and some of that was trying to be explained last night. It's not that we didn't care or didn't want to help that customer, but there had to have been something different with the wires that had to be fixed differently than that particular truck could do.
Alice Drager, while ago here, yes, on the show, mentioned that your computer system would identify areas that had power restored, but there were individual houses on the block that were still without,
correct,
power. How did that happen?
It's because it's probably an old system, and Mr. Lark last night explained that he had been looking, put an RFP out for a new OMS system that would show outages in a more convenient, better way, or
real time
way.
Yeah.
That has not happened yet. He's talked several times that it should be done by the end of the year. That's one of the long term changes that he's offered out as a solution.
Did you attend last week's special Lansing City Council meeting?
Oh, yes.
Are you taking into consideration all of the intense criticism that was aired then?
Yes.
Okay.
And most of, after listening to it, most of the criticism was just that immediate frustration. It was Christmas. It was cold. People have, elderly people. They have children. They have pets that needed to be taken care of. And some of the answers that they wanted, when could they get power restored, type of things, were not being answered, and we understood that frustration. And obviously the outage is over, so that major frustration is over. They still can't imagine why we didn't have the answers, and we are trying to look at putting together some things that will make this never happen again, hopefully.
You voiced support for Peter Lark. Did anything you hear last night lead you to reconsider that support?
No, absolutely not. Peter, from the conversations I had with him and from what I've seen from him in the last 6 years, he is a visionary. He wants changes. He wants plans. His goal, one of the biggest goals that he had when he got hired by me, was to change the image of the Board of Water and Light. If everybody remembers, we had someone that was let go in somewhat of controversy, Mr. Pandy. And when he got hired, he realized that the image of the Board of Water and Light had been damaged, and one of the goals was, when he got hired was to improve the image of the Board of Water and Light. And from what I've been able to see in the 6 years that he's been with us, that he has done a lot to do that.
Now, he was contrite again last night about his decision to leave town for New York in the middle of this power outage, but it was clear last night that for several speakers, that act in and of itself was unforgivable. That despite the other accomplishments that you allude to and that many others have alluded to that have taken place under Peter Lark's leadership, that is a deal breaker. What do you think?
No, I don't think it's a deal breaker. He's admitted it's wrong. From my knowledge, most of the commissioners have indicated to him that probably wasn't the best decision that he ever made, and he has said that several times. If he had it to do over again, it wouldn't happen. But
do you feel the rest of the board generally agrees with you on that?
Yes.
And they are generally supportive of him at this point?
Yes. You know, realizing that he's owned up and said that probably wasn't, it's probably one of the mistakes that he will have to live with. I mean, that people will not forget this. However, there was never a time that he was not in charge of the Board of Water and Light. He was on the phone, and that was one of the things that brought him back. He said he just couldn't even get off the phone. He realized that he had to get back.
Much has been made of his, quote, golden parachute contract. Can you clarify for us what the severance provisions are in his contract? The payout options should he resign or be fired?
You know, I hate to say this, but I can't remember exactly, you know, what it is he does. But Peter has told me several times when we've had the discussion about his contract that if the board doesn't want me, I'm just going.
Yeah, but he's going away with a nice sum of money, regardless of the circumstances, as I understand it.
Yes, and I don't. Again, I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly what you know, whether he gets 2 years, a year, you know, what is if that happens.
At one point, Lansing City Council member Jody Washington seemed to suggest that the board needs to take some kind of disciplinary action against Mr. Lark, short of dismissal, I believe, was her point. Yeah. What do you think of that idea?
I don't know what kind of a disciplinary action that you can take. Peter's salaried, so we can't say you don't get any overtime for all the work you've put in the last 2 weeks in particular. So I'm not sure exactly what that disciplinary action would be.
Could you reopen his contract, though, and extract what other people would, a half a pound of flesh over any of these indiscretions or the trip to New York City? Could you reopen his contract and rejigger that?
I'm sure that we could. However, his contract is up every year, and that is up in June. And so that's something that we will look at. We do a full evaluation of the three employees that the board employs at the Board of Water and Light. That would be the corporate secretary, the internal auditor, and Mr. Lark is the general manager. And so every year we do a complete review, independent review. Each commissioner gets to independently review them, and then the numbers are put together as a whole.
Let's we've got to spend a minute or two on these various reforms that Peter announced last night. One that jumped out at me was that the operation management system, I'm sorry, the outage management system, the OMS, those issues have been addressed, identified and addressed. Now, I'd been led to believe that these have been hanging fire for months, and now it appears they've been addressed in a matter of days. How is that possible?
They've been probably, I wasn't clear on all that. What he's been telling me is that he knew that the system was old. Sure. And he had put out an RFP a couple of months ago for companies to give us a new system. So I don't know whether that was meaning that they are going to, it's there, you know, that they've gotten the RFP, they're going to be able to get it. He's been telling us that the system, it'll take roughly towards the end of this year, but it may be that he's actually able to have purchased or got an RFP for some company to come in and install that system.
And we're just about out of time, but I have to ask you about the review that is forthcoming. Is this going to be an independent review or an inside review? How will that proceed?
To begin with, Peter has told us that he's going to do an internal review, and he's going to hold several town hall-type meetings where the clients or the customers and the different elected officials that have expressed concerns can come in and offer suggestions, ask questions, and then at that point he's going to take his staff and put together that internal review. It'll come to us as a commission, and then at that point we'll try to determine whether or not we actually need an external review. From my understanding, the mayor is going to also offer an independent review.
Okay, we have to leave it there. Sure. Sandy, I'm awful sorry. I know it was a short night for you, and we appreciate your being here today on Current State.
Yes, it was, and thank you.
All right, we'll have you back. That's our show for today. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.